From the Sky News Centre at 5, the last British resident to be held at Guantanamo Bay for nearly 14 years is now back in the UK. Barry Weir reports.
Shakir Amar arrived on a private plane at an airport in Kent this lunchtime. Police officers accompanied him, but he wasn't arrested. Joanne McInnes has campaigned for his release.
Everybody, you know, that I come across is just euphoric about this.
Mr. Amar was detained in Afghanistan in 2001, accused of being a close associate of Osama bin Laden. He says he was there doing charity work. He was held without trial and first cleared for release back in 2007. Peter Tatchell is a human rights campaigner.
I think there needs to be an investigation into why this prolonged period of additional detention after clearance for release.
Shakir Amar has paid tribute to his supporters, saying, "Without their devotion to justice, I would not be here in Britain now."
A 16-year-old appeared in court in Aberdeen, charged with the murder of a local schoolboy. Bailey Gwynn was stabbed on Wednesday and died from his injuries in hospital. Harry Clark, the driver involved in the Glasgow bin lorry crash last year, has resigned shortly before he was up before a disciplinary hearing. The City Council was about to sack him after it emerged that he kept a history of blackouts from them. The Foreign Secretary says talks on the future of Syria have been long but productive. All the major players backing rival sides in the country's civil war met for the first time. Until now, Iran hasn't been involved in the talks. Well, Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond says they discussed where they all agreed and also where they don't.
We've explored some of those differences, most obviously around the future of Bashar al-Assad. We've agreed that our officials will work together to try to narrow those differences.
More than 450 jobs are going at several UK sites operated by steel firm Capero. Unions have described it as another devastating blow to their industry. And the new James Bond film Spectre has broken UK box office records, taking £6.3 million on its opening day on Monday. It's slightly more than the last 007 movie Skyfall took. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Helping me review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Cotton, Dani Glazard, who's on the way her way here in a taxi because she's had a flat tyre. After the 6 o'clock news, were the 7-7 suicide bombers trained by British Special Forces? And were warnings sent to West Yorkshire Police 2 years before the 2005 7-7 London attacks? Plus, on 9/11, we follow the money trail. Who made a killing out of the deaths of over 3,000 New Yorkers that day? Part two of my interview from Buenos Aires with British journalist Lawrence DeMello. Also, as part of our tribute to veteran MP Michael Meacher, who died last week, we hear him talk about oil, how the Project for a New American Century are using it to help the United States take over the world, using that war on terror, that old chestnut, as a pretext. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. So, helping us review this week's news, we'll be here in a minute, Green Councillor for Cotton, Dani Glazard. In the meantime, Martin Summers, we've had quite a momentous announcement today, haven't we, about the release from Guantanamo of Shakir Amar, who's the longest-serving British resident there. He was brought into Guantanamo Bay back in 2001-2002 with a price on his head, the idea being that that there were bounties of something like $5,000 given for any foreign national that special forces or other people could actually find over in Afghanistan.
Well, yes, it's a pretty horrendous scenario. If you think about it, there's no legal basis for these people to be held. And, of course, the Cuban government doesn't want Guantanamo base to exist in the first place. It's actually their sovereign territory. So the whole thing is a complete defiance, if you like, of the rule of law from the get-go.
Well, what do you say to those that say, well, actually, this guy could be a dangerous terrorist?
Well, if he is, they should have put him on trial and prove the case. Don't forget that our suspicion, and the suspicion people like the Russian General Staff and the Iranian General Staff, is that terrorism, particularly Islamic jihadi terrorism, is actually orchestrated by the intelligence services. Now, if they want us not to think like that, then they have got to have proper trials with proper juries, proper judges, and then we'll find out who really is behind the terrorism which we know exists. And if you're not going to do that, then we're entitled to conclude that you've got something to hide and that you are, in fact, running these terrorists as part of your global war-fighting strategy.
Now, I noticed Shaka has been flown by private jet into Biggin Hill Airfield, just south of London. That's where I used to work, actually, years ago. And Biggin Hill Airport themselves, who have been privatised since I was there, used to be run by a local authority. And they have actually refused to say what was happening. It's one of those weird things. Well, the whole of the world knows that's where he's going, but the airport themselves say, we refuse to confirm or deny. This sort of approach, which is all to do effectively with holding back information, people who are afraid to give information, smacks of the security services, and they apparently have been involved in this Shakarama case, haven't they?
Well, they probably have. I mean, they no doubt were.
Well, one of the things he said is that they were present at some of the torture, or around some of the torture, and certainly seemed to be supervising it from one step removed from behind the scenes. So give us a picture of how the security services have been involved since the beginning of the war on terror.
Well, one of the things that happens is you use these internment camps, which is what these places are, as a means of recruiting agents. So you round people up, and then if they weren't terrorists before, you can then recruit them to be terrorists, but under your control. So one of the stories that have leaked out of Guantanamo is that there are two sections to Guantanamo. One is Strawberry Fields, where people are never released, usually people who've actually got no background in terrorism, because therefore they can't be released without embarrassment. And then you've got Penny Lane, where basically people are recruited to work for the Western Intelligence Services. So the people who set up Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which then sent off the so-called underpants bomber to Schiphol Airport to get on the plane without going through security, they had been in Guantanamo Bay. And this guy, al-Baghdadi, who has been named as the leader of ISIS, he was originally in prison in Iraq in a similar sort of circumstances. And if you can actually arrange for people to be kept without proper habeas corpus, you can then pressurise them into working for you and working as terrorists for you. And that is the allegation. That is what, you know, the Iranian General Staff and the Russian General Staff believe, that many of these jihadi terrorists are in fact working for Western Intelligence Services.
Are you saying some of them may be working with ISIS, for ISIS, or even commanders of ISIS?
Well, today the Iraqi forces, the Iraqi military, have said that they have captured ISIS commanders who say that they are getting logistical support and intelligence support from the US. Now, we don't hear about this in the mainstream media in the West, but everybody in the Middle East has their own access to media and information. And 80%, they did a survey inside Syria not long ago, a YouGov survey, I think it was. 80% of the people inside Syria believe ISIS is a front for Western intelligence services and the Saudi Arabians. Now, in actual fact, that's common knowledge on the ground in Syria, but not in South Bristol.
What about can we assume that Shakarama was a Strawberry Fields man who just refused to work for the Americans?
Well, it's more likely that he's a random person that they've picked up, and they can't really release him after they've held him for years without admitting that he didn't actually have anything to do with anything. Guantanamo Bay, don't forget, is only the visible part of the secret gulag that's been set up. There are all sorts of prisons that we don't even know the existence of. Probably in Diego Garcia, for example, there is still a prison. And there are certainly, I mean, at one stage, when we were friendly with Libya and Syria, people would be sent to Libya and Syria to be tortured by the regimes there because they were in alliance with us, supposedly, against Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc. But of course, increasingly, it's becoming clear because of what's happened in Syria that the links between Western intelligence services, the Saudi Mukhabarat, and the jihadi Wahhabist Salafi terrorists is as intimate as it ever was back in the 1980s.
Well, waiting for Danny here still. It's almost like the first hour has turned into the second hour, Martin.
Yeah.
And also, the we've also got news today that the Americans and the British are to send special forces to fight on the ground in Syria now. This is starting to hot up, isn't it?
Well, there's no legal basis. You see, if you send special forces into Syria, say, we are sending special forces into
Syria. Well, the Russians would say the same, wouldn't they?
No, the Russians have been invited by the recognised government.
But the international community, many of them, have said that there should be regime change and Assad should...
No, but as things stand at the moment, the seat in the United Nations of Syria is occupied by the current regime. And that is the legal position. So if you send special forces into Syria to do anything, and the Syrian regime says it doesn't want you there, then that is illegal. And therefore, of course, if they're captured, they can't expect to be treated as prisoners of war. They'll either be treated as criminals or killed out of hand.
Okay, so do you think what sort of things are we going to be hearing from Sheikh Arama? Obviously, he wants to spend some time with his family, but I mean, one of the reasons that's been given by many of the people that know him, lawyers and campaigners, Andy Worthington has done a fantastic job on this particular campaign, not single-handedly, but he's led a lot of the writing and a lot of the campaigning around getting Shaka released. Done a fantastic job on it. By the way, Andy's also the author of the book about the Battle of the Beanfield from many years ago. So he's taken a lot of this civil rights, human rights campaigns, really looking after the rights of travellers, the peace convoy, those sorts of people in the 1980s, and he's taken that right into the heart of the war on terrorism and Guantanamo Bay, Martin.
Well, that's very very commendable of him. I've no idea what Sheikh Arama will say. Probably, as you say, he'll probably want to talk to his family after 13 years.
One of the things that a lot of these people are saying is that one of the reasons that they've taken such a long time to release him, even though they weren't holding him under any kind of legal jurisdiction at all, was because they're frightened about him going on to Newsnight, these other programmes, well, and talking
indeed,
about his experience.
If you've held somebody for 13 years, which is essentially a life sentence, and then you release them and it turns out that you've got no evidence against them of any terrorist activity whatsoever, then of course the chances are that they're going to be quite annoyed and they're going to talk about it. I mean, doesn't this suggest something? If they had anything on him that would stand up in a court of law, they would have used it, but they haven't, so they've not been able to. And of course the illegality of what they're doing is the key. You might say, oh well, never mind, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, we're fighting terrorism, etc. But don't forget the major allegation that's being made, as I say, by people like the Russian General Staff, the Iranian General Staff, is that jihadi terrorism of the Sunni variety is virtually 100% controlled by Western intelligence services. Now, the only way to get to the bottom of that and either find out whether it's true is to have proper trials, proper courts, proper juries and all the rest of it. It's not an optional add-on. If you don't have proper trials and courts and juries and all the rest of it, people are entitled to conclude that the allegation that you're running these terrorists as a means to for geopolitical reasons is proved by default. And if the state doesn't fulfil its own criteria of legality, then it's illegal. Then it is, in fact, a pointing a finger at the state as being a terrorist state, not just a slightly overzealous state.
One of the allegations that Sheikh Arama's made from Guantanamo Bay through his lawyers and spokespeople is that MI5 were around as he was being tortured and others were being tortured. So, you know, how on earth is anyone going to hold MI5, the security services, the people who are supposed to look after our safety but seem to be almost totally unaccountable? How is anyone going to hold these people to account?
Well, the principle is clear. Sheikh Arama should sue the British government and MI5.
Well, there's another thing they're saying. He should receive around about £1 million compensation from the British taxpayer.
Well, yes, and he should then use that money to engage lawyers to sue the government. The fact is, if MI5 were involved in torture, that's illegal. The MI5 officers concerned should be prosecuted and sent to prison. And if their defence is we were doing it under orders, we then get hold of the politicians who gave them the orders. That's how you crush terrorism. I believe in zero tolerance for terrorism. terrorism, and we believe that most of the terrorism has been orchestrated from inside the intelligence services, like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's last seen inside Iraq, inside the Green Zone. He's already had a finger pointed at him by British police as being behind the Loyalist terror campaign in Northern Ireland. He should be put on trial, and he should be convicted if he's guilty and sent to prison, and people should then listen to what the courts really say.
The other thing is, Martin, that Shaka Rahm has been saying, and he's paid an emotional tribute to those that fought for his release after he finally returned to the UK today, saying, without their devotion to justice, I would not be here in Britain now. And he went on to say, in a statement issued an hour or so ago, the reason I've been strong is because of the support of people so strongly devoted to the truth.
Well, I mean, that's heartening to hear, but it's still 13 years out of his life, and in any case, the whole business of holding these people is completely illegal, and those who've been involved in holding them should be prosecuted.
Now, this is two ends.
It's kidnapping.
Two ends, really, here, of the war on terror. One is the Guantanamo Bay end, the other one is Afghanistan, and one of the people who was very good, certainly as far as I can see, explaining the war on terror, looking into its origins and what it's really all about, was the Labour MP Michael Meacher, who died last week. So let's hear now from him a few minutes of him giving an exposition on this and its relationship to things like the energy industries.
The Project for a New America Century is a think tank. It's a pretty extreme right-wing think tank, and it drafted a document in September 2000 in the course of the presidential election campaign for Bush, which was called Strengthening America's Defenses. And it makes very interesting reading. It's pretty chilling. It talks in regard to the Middle East about how the flow of oil into the international markets had been interrupted by Saddam Hussein's regime, and that it was necessary to remove that, if necessary, by military means. Don't forget, this was written in September 2000. That is a year before 9/11 and 3 years before the Iraq War. It also says that even if Saddam Hussein were removed from the scene, it would still be necessary to take this action in the Middle East. So the American motive is revealed by this not to be antagonism to Saddam Hussein, who we all know is a brutal, sadistic tyrant, but it is not the human rights issues or the justice issues. It is the fact that he stood in the way of American control over oil. He used it for his interests, not the Americans' interests, and that was not acceptable to the US. What the PNAC document also goes on to say is that we need to resist any country or group of countries for which, read, the EU or Japan challenging our leadership or our regional leadership. It talks about the need for American space forces, because the Americans supported the militarization of space and they wish to be in control of that. They talk about full spectrum dominance, in other words, American control over every aspect of military conflict, and one of those is control over the internet, so that there cannot be any cybernetic opposition to US interests. It talks about the need for more US forces in Southeast Asia. And although it doesn't actually say the need for regime change in China, that would be going too far. The implication is that we need to exert more pressure for the kind of change that we would like to see in that region. And indeed, even that has happened, because China, Russia, Iran are all at the moment circled by American bases. There are now 700 bases, American bases across the world. There are 135 countries out of 190 that now have American bases in them. That's about 70% of all the countries in the world. So we have seen this explosion of American power, physical control on the ground. using every opportunity, unrest in the Caucasus, the southern flank of Soviet Russia, the so-called Orange and Tulip and other revolutions occurring there, which is trying to get Western control of those countries to get the oil out of the Caspian. So all of this has happened, which I think largely reflects what was always the policy of the Bush administration, as revealed by this PNAC document. What it ends by saying is that this, it says at the end of the document, is going to take a long time. I think you can underline those words. It's going to take a long time. Dash, absent, which is the American word for except. Except there is a catastrophic or catalyzing event like Pearl Harbor.
Well, isn't that interesting? I mean, Michael Meacher, of all the senior politicians, is the longest-serving Labour cabinet minister, in fact. He was one of the mainstream politicians who, from the very beginning, were questioning the official story of 9/11. And, of course, you know, the project for a new American century is almost like the Mein Kampf of our era. It's laid out what the oligarchy stroke military-industrial complex were intending to do. You know, we simply have to read it to know what their thinking is.
He also did an article for The Guardian, didn't he, saying the war on terrorism is bogus.
He did.
What did he mean by that?
Well, he meant basically he's raised questions about the 9/11 event. He's one of the few mainstream politicians who have been prepared to do that. And so, well, actually, I don't believe what the story you're telling us about this. And, of course, he's been backed up by people like General Ivashov, who was the former chief of staff of the Russian Armed Forces, General Gul, who was the head of the ISI in Pakistan. All sorts of people have questioned the official story of 9/11, but we won't hear that in the mainstream media in this country, will you?
Anyway, we've also been joined by Danny Glazard now. I think, Danny, you've managed to get here by taxi, did you, after you got a flat tyre?
Yeah, that's right. Quite cliche.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and what made you decide to get into politics. Why particularly the Green Party?
I suppose it's interesting coming off the back of that because I was, I think, 13 in 2001 and growing up in a traditionally Labour family, but not seeing people around me, like parties around me that represented my views. And then off the back of the mayor election in Bristol, I started getting involved with the Green Party. They seemed to be the party that were best representing my views locally and nationally, so I was impressed by what they were saying. Actually, before the mayor election, there was the referendum on whether or not to have a mayor, and I thought the Greens were most clearly articulating why they thought we shouldn't have one, and then following that, and then the further I looked into things like national policies and so on, things on welfare, things on social justice, things on sustainability, the Greens were like representing my views. So I got involved for some pretty like high level issues, and then I found myself getting stuck into some of the local stuff more recently.
And what other jobs have you got, or do you do, or where, you know, what's your background?
So I work for, I used to work for the National Union of Students, and now I work for the Students Union at Bristol University.
So were you one of the rabble rousers that got everybody onto the streets of London just after the last general election, previous general election?
I've definitely been on the streets of London around student issues many, many times. For the big 2010 demonstrations, I was living in Canada, so I was not there. But I've worked with the NUS and worked with all the follow-up to that campaign.
What's your view? Obviously, you're talking to a lot of students of the whole attitude of students nowadays. I mean, when Martin and I went to university, college, whatever, got our degrees, it was very easy financially. You got a grant to go and do it, and you know, there was quite a lot of free time. Now it seems most students seem to be absolutely blazing the whole time and have hardly any free time at all, because they've got to have jobs to pay, and then at the end of it all, then they end up with a massive debt. So I mean, how do modern students cope with all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot like what you've said, really. I think if you look at statistics about mental health and stuff, the mental health of students is diminishing, and there's increasing pressures. And of course, I think the people that feel the pressures most are probably the people that are least likely to go to university in the first place. So, as with anything about the most recent like recent policies, whether it's cuts or kind of fees aren't cuts as such, but it's part of a similar package. It's like the effect is disproportionate from what I can see. So I used to work past our students' union. You have far more students that aren't coming from a privileged background, and you see the effects on those students. You see them working like lots of hours in jobs far more than you see kind of more privileged students feeling those effects.
So what are you actually doing at the NUS? What's your job there?
I'm not at the NUS anymore. At the NUS I used to work for their liberation campaigns, their equality and diversity campaigns, and I work for the SU, and my job is basically to support the elected officers, so working with campaigns, helping them get briefed for meetings, helping them negotiate things with the university, running the elections.
How political is it? I mean, are you given complete freedom to follow any kind of, there was a lot, I can remember as a student, there was quite a lot of contention sometimes about, the university doesn't want to fund this particular aspect of student clubs or activities, that kind of thing.
Sure, so the Students' Union can absolutely be political, and it's kind of as political as the officers are. As a staff member, I'm almost like the civil servant within the Students' Union, so I'm not meant to be, I can't bring my Green Party stuff in directly, and like I have to be neutral in terms of party politics, but we can challenge officers on policy and try and help their shape their thinking, if that makes sense, and that's definitely part of my role.
So a bit of both.
Yeah.
Just here in Bristol, you're in Cotton. Have you managed to save Cotton Library? Because I know it was one of the ones that was earmarked for closure.
Yeah, so Redland Library, which is just the opposite side of the road to Cotton. Yes, the library is saved. I think we set up a group called Friends of Redland Library who campaigned to save the library, and I think that group's now kind of looking at its next stage as to how can we keep it saved for good, and how can we get local people involved in sustaining the library, not necessarily through volunteers. That's kind of quite controversial.
And one of the things I've brought up over the last couple of weeks is doing a little bit of research into up and coming full council meetings. You'll be voting, I think it's the 12th of December, on changes to all these park bylaws. Now, this was something which was brought in, you probably weren't around, last year, in May, and councillors decided no, they didn't want to vote to approve it, so they sent it back, and it's now come bouncing back 18 months later, virtually the same, but it's just got lots and lots more paperwork, another couple of inches of papers saying why people should vote for it. But one of the things that's included in that is the power for the council civil enforcement officers to go into Bristol's parks and evict people in tents who've got nowhere to live. Now, this just seems so counterproductive as to be almost unbelievable. Since you've got nowhere to live, one of the only places you've got to go is to pitch a tent in a park and live in there. And all this is likely to do is simply to drive the homeless situation out of the public eye. So I just wonder if you'll be voting for or against that when it comes up in December.
Put me on the spot. I was saying to you before, I think you've read my papers before I have. But certainly I've looked at the bylaws, and I think I would not agree with kind of a punitive approach to that sort of thing at all. And I think, if there's a homelessness problem in Bristol, then that we need to deal with homelessness, not with people sleeping in
parks.
But
we've come a long way, haven't we? From the days when councils used to build houses and make sure everyone was housed. They just don't do that anymore.
Well, and I think they are looking at it in Bristol, and it's a struggle. There was a housing inquiry
day
last week.
But there's no money for
last week.
They can look at it. I mean, they could. Look at a picture on the wall, but
there are obviously there's national funding issues that affect Bristol City Council are looking at how they can create affordable housing that's missing its current target. So how it's then going to increase on that target is something that officers are and councillors are kind of like developing various strategies. I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say. I'm not going to lie. It's all out in the open, but I don't actually know the details. But they're looking at different policy. It shouldn't be parks.
One of the things that they're saying is, although they've got the power, they might not use it. Well, if the power's there, the chances are they probably will. If you're in a tent and you've got nowhere else to go, they almost certainly will. Martin, what do you make of this? Because it's, effectively, we've got a completely broken housing policy. We've heard this week, although I think it was yesterday morning on Radio 4 News, there was just one line. I've never heard them do that on Radio 4 about there's actually been a stalling in the house building programme. It was the major plank of David Cameron's speech at his conference a month or so ago, and now we hear, rather than building houses, what's happening is an enormous fall off in social housing being built, but even private housing is there's less in this present quarter than there was the same time last year. So it's a stalling. They're not building houses.
Well, I mean, the Conservative Party traditionally, and even more so nowadays, is based upon stoking up property bubbles. I mean, that's basically what they do.
Well, it's not anymore. If you're not actually building houses and selling
them...
Well,
there's an international report that came out this week, which I was reading about this morning, that shows that the London property market is the most overvalued in the world. Now, this is actually... there's a contradiction here. Everybody claims to want affordable housing, in theory. In practice, we are now selling off social housing to existing tenants, and effectively the Tories won the last election on the back of rising house prices in various marginal constituencies in the southeast of England. So this is the way they operate. This is the way the system operates. It's to goose up the housing market for selected sections of the population, which is free money basically. But I mean, in places like Germany, the average price of a house hasn't changed in 40 or 50 years. There's no reason why it should. If supply and demand are met and there's a coherent social housing policy, then house prices shouldn't move at all. And that's where you want to be. Because in actual fact, that means, for example, in German dinner parties, people don't talk about what latest conservatories they've constructed. They talk about their business ideas. And that's the difference between Germany and Britain.
What some commentators have been saying, I read some fantastic Guardian article, I don't often say that, but actually really good article the other day about this, where they're suggesting that actually what's happening is because the housing bubble is so enormous, because house prices are so massively overinflated at the moment, although these private house builders can build the houses, they can't actually sell them. So they've got these houses that they built out that are not selling, and so they're thinking, well, hang on, we better make sure we've sold those before we build any more. And so the whole process of bringing new houses onto the market is slowing down and stalling.
Well, indeed, that's what you would do if you were a house builder, a private sector house builder. The biggest council house drive was in the 1950s, had a Conservative government, they built the most council houses. That effectively undermined the private housing market. You don't expect house prices to rise if people can choose to rent decent accommodation at a reasonable rate. And that's what you want. The purpose of having a substantial social housing sector is to cool off the property market so that you don't have to raise interest rates to rein it in, so that your industry can actually get money easily and invest in the future, green technology, whatever, rather than everybody. I mean, they leave university and they want to get on the housing ladder, where's my free money? I'm middle class, I want free money. We get used to it in this country. People really believe that if they get to a certain stage of their social development, they're entitled to free money by getting on the housing ladder. It's not rational.
The other thing we've seen in Bristol is where developers just sit on sites until, I don't know if this is widely known, I feel like becoming council, I've become baptised in fire.
Land banking.
They're just sitting on sites where they've even had planning permission, but then they're not doing anything, but they're not building the houses that we need in Bristol because they want to make more money, they want to wait till the moment's right to build it, or even just sell the land.
It just goes up in value anyway.
Right, exactly.
And then you can borrow against that, speculate.
It's all hypothetical.
Yeah,
it's
so these people aren't actually developers, are they, really? They're speculators.
Exactly.
Yeah, so oh dear. Martin, where is this all heading?
A crash. Where else? That's what happens.
Well,
and then everybody goes, oh, how did that happen? I mean, it's quite clear what will happen. I've seen several of these housing bubbles and crashes in my lifetime. This is probably going to be the biggest one, and it'll either crash under its own steam, because these things do, or it'll be some external event, some country defaults or whatever. But it's there's no rationality to it. The policy on social housing used to be across the board. Even the Conservative government of the 1950s and 1960s built council houses because they knew it was a necessary thing. Even Labour governments don't bother now.
Let's go back to Michael Meacher anyway now and hear from Dave and Jeremy in the House of Commons at Westminster at Prime Minister's Questions.
What a good place Britain is to do business. I'm pleased to say we're now sixth in the rankings in the world for the best place to set up and to run a business. And I know that the Leader of the Opposition, not least because his new spokesman is apparently a great admirer of the Soviet Union, will be very pleased to start the day with tractor statistics.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I start by associating myself with the remarks the Prime Minister just made about Michael Meacher? And on behalf of the Labour Party, his constituents and a much wider community, our condolences to his family. I spoke to them last night and asked them how they would like Michael to be remembered. So they thought about it and sent me a very nice message, which, if I may, Mr. Speaker, I'll read out. It's quite brief, but it's very poignant. And this is what they said as memories of Michael. When I was young, one of the things he frequently said to me was that people went into politics because they had principles and wanted to change things to make the world better, but that in order to get into power, they would often compromise on their principles, and that this could happen again and again until, if they eventually did get into power, they would have become so compromised that they would do nothing with it. Those of us that knew Michael knew him as a decent, hard-working, passionate and profound man. He represented his constituency with diligence and distinction for 45 years. He was a brilliant environment minister, as the Prime Minister has pointed out. He was totally committed to parliamentary democracy, and that this Parliament holding government, all governments, to account, and he was a lifelong campaigner against injustice and poverty. We remember Michael for all of those things. We express our condolences. We express our sympathies to his family at this very difficult time. His will be a hard act to follow, but we'll do our best. Mr. Speaker, following the events in the other place on Monday evening and the rather belated acceptance from the Prime Minister of the result there, can he now guarantee to the House and to the wider country that nobody will be worse off next year as a result of cuts to working tax credits?
What I can guarantee is that we remain committed to the vision of a high pay, low tax, lower welfare economy. And we believe the way to make sure that everyone is better off is keep growing our economy, keep inflation low, keep cutting people's taxes, and introduce the national living wage. As for our changes, the Chancellor will set them out in the autumn statement.
Now, Martin, a couple of things there. First of all, with the Michael Meacher piece, what do you think of what he was saying about this whole thing of people being compromised in politics, and when they get power eventually that they don't do anything with it because they're so compromised?
Well, it's always a danger, and I think the electoral system doesn't help, because it forces things into an unnatural triangulation where everybody's attempting to kind of capture a mythical middle ground.
Well, if the cabinet and the executive seem to hold almost all the power,
well, indeed.
And it's very, very difficult to become a cabinet minister. Well, if you start rocking the boat, you're never going to do it, are you?
The famous Labour politician Nye Bevan started off as an anarchist. When he was a young man, he was a trade union activist, and he was an anarchist. He believed in workers' control of industry, and he didn't particularly believe in parliamentary democracy. But after the defeat of the general strike in 1926, he decided he'd have to go into politics, so he got elected to the local council. And then he said, I got elected to the local council and realised I didn't have any power, so I got elected to the county council. Got elected to the county council, I didn't realise I had any realised I didn't have any power, so I got elected to parliament. And then I realised I didn't have any power as an MP, so I got to be a minister. And even as a minister, I felt that I didn't even have any power, because in actual fact, the real power isn't actually in the political system. There's a permanent government and corporate power which exists independently of official politics.
Like, what are you talking about, the banksters?
Well, we're talking about the banks, the military-industrial complex, and the intelligence services, yeah.
Danny, what do you make of that point, that the quote Jeremy Corbyn was reading there from Michael Meacher about having to make so many compromises, and eventually politicians end up, when they finally get power, not being able to use it, so they're so compromised?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a lot of sympathy with it. I think something that I've been thinking about a lot, and Caroline Lucas wrote a book about Westminster and how it works, and I think, like, getting it positions of power certainly isn't enough to affect change, and because you're stuck in a system that doesn't work. So whether, I mean, I think, like, you know, there are other, obviously, like corporate power and stuff. In theory, Parliament should be able to regulate their power, but in practice, I think you get kind of this, like, systemic I don't know, this is systemic problems which stop anybody. Like, you can work yourself all the way up and still not really be able to affect the change that you wanted when you went in there, I think. And I think that's why we need reform.
David Cameron would probably say, well, I've wanted a change, and it was to get rid of working tax credits for quite a lot of people, about 3 million people. We were voted to do this, and now an unelected House of Lords is saying, no, you can't.
Yeah, well, I like the way that David Cameron and George Osborne are suddenly emphasising that the House of Lords are unelected, now they've become a problem to them. Like, I think, yes, we need constitutional change, and yes, we need an elected House of Lords, but actually what the House of Lords is there to do is to act as a balance and check for the House of Commons, and in this case, they've done something right. You know, like, David Cameron is suddenly worried about the House of Lords being unelected once they've become a problem to him, and in this instance, they've stepped in, I think, and kind of performed their correct, if not technically correct, kind of role in the situation.
Martin, what do you make about Monday's little debacle with the Lords telling George Osborne and David Cameron no?
The fact is that the cutting tax credits was not in the Tory manifesto, and the Prime Minister himself said, we are not going to cut tax credits.
Yeah,
he's on the record of saying that.
Yeah, as did Michael Gove.
Now, therefore, it's quite legitimate for the Lords to say, well, hang on, you can't just bulldoze this through on that basis. Because don't forget, if we'd had a PR election, we would have had a much bigger contingent of UKIP MPs. So you would have had probably a UKIP Conservative alliance would have been the outcome of the last election if there had been a PR, if it had been done under PR. But the UKIP voters wouldn't necessarily, the UKIP MPs wouldn't necessarily have gone along with this. So the Tories have only got 37% of the vote at the last election. They can't just railroad stuff through. And the House of Lords are performing a perfectly legitimate function of saying, look, you haven't actually got a mandate for this. And of course the Sun and the Murdoch press have also opposed the government on this. And I think that probably means if you did an opinion poll, it'd show that most people were opposed to the cuts in tax credits. So the fact is that they can't just railroad them through. Good.
What about this in the Independent on the 20th of October? This is, I mean, just I look at this and I think, good God, what the hell's going on here? The Tories are removing twice as many people, says John Stone in the Independent, from the electoral register in Britain's poorest areas as the richest. Canary Wharf is a picture of that here in the paper, and the poorest areas lose out far more than the richest from the changes. Conservatives' changes to electoral registration will disproportionately remove people from the electoral register in poorer areas of the country. Analysis suggests over twice as many voters will be removed, Danny, from the register in 10 poorest areas of the UK compared with the richest areas outside London. Now, this just sounds just totally wrong, because there's a kind of whole thing of individual voter registration coming along, and it's going to mean that a lot of the people that you work with, students for example, are not going to be on the electoral register.
Sure, yeah. The IER started coming in before the last general election, and we saw like tens of thousands of students.
What did you call it then?
Sorry, it's individual electoral registration, IER. So it came in just before the general election, or started to come in, and tens of thousands of students dropped off the register. Some councils were paying for people to go door to door to like try and re-register people, and certainly a lot of students' unions went door to door, and a lot of political parties went door to door, but people didn't understand the process. Like, we still saw on the day students who didn't know they had to be registered, didn't know how it was set up.
So are you saying that councils had wiped the slate clean and were starting again from scratch?
They didn't wipe the slate clean, and actually it's been a while, but essentially certain people fell off the register, and it's to do with like how long you've been at a certain address or how many addresses you had registered and so on.
So hang on a minute, this is actually really totally unfair, isn't it? So if you're someone that maybe hasn't got a lot of money, or you have to move around quite a bit, you're much more likely to drop off the register than somebody who's wealthy, got somewhere permanent to live.
Yeah, well, I mean, in Cottam, obviously, there are huge numbers of HMOs, and it certainly wasn't like it was the HMOs where people weren't registered correctly. It was not the people where they were homeowners that had problems with the electoral registration. Yeah.
Well, this is even more sinister than it first appears, because the intention is to redraw. They're going to reduce the number of MPs to 600, which implies redrawing the constituency boundaries. But the constituency boundaries will be redrawn on the basis of these corrupt electoral registers. If they weren't going to withdraw the constituency boundaries, all that would happen in inner city areas, for example, is that less people would be registered to vote, but one MP would still be elected for that area. And in actual fact, the district should be based upon the demographics rather than on the registration. But this is US-style politics, where we're ultimately moving towards gerrymandering as normal practice. And, of course, under a first-past-the-post system, which gives disproportionate power to certain voters in certain marginal constituencies. And, of course, what will ultimately happen with that, if, for example, is that the Scots will just say, we're having near more of this, and walk away. As in Northern Ireland, of course, we had a 30-year civil war around the issue of who got to vote and on what basis. That's really what it was about.
We also had a discussion, didn't we, with Simon Hines, Martin, a few weeks ago about vote fraud, because there's quite a lot of ways in which you can fix an election in this country. Postal voting is just one of them, but this whole gerrymandering seems like there's a whole smorgasbord there of different methods.
Well, there is, and of course they're getting political advisers over from the United States. In the United States, it is normal practice to carry out what they call voter suppression. So it's quite difficult to register to vote in many parts of the United States. It's all done locally, so the local officials are very much in charge of it,
it's like a wall of bureaucracy.
Yeah, they just make it very, very difficult for people on low incomes, black people, people of minorities, and so on to register. And in actual fact, the turnout in US elections is less than half of the registered voters, and the registered voters don't include the vast majority of the population.
And then when you do turn out to vote, sometimes you're faced with a mile long queue.
Well, also, of course, in the United States, they also just cheat outright. I mean, both Bush elections were outright cheats, both the first time and the second time, using the electronic voting machines in Ohio. And of course, this is normal practice in places like Mexico, and of course that's fine, and we're moving down that road. But we've already been there and done it and got the t-shirt in Northern Ireland. It was the whole in Northern Ireland, people couldn't register to vote in local elections unless they were a householder, and the allocation of council housing was then done on a discriminatory basis, so that more Protestants had household registration, were heads of household and could vote, and Catholics with big families in crowded accommodation had less votes. And of course, ultimately, that led to the civil rights movement, and then led to Bloody Sunday and everything that followed from that. So, in other words, this kind of manipulation by the Conservative government is extremely dangerous and unwise.
Danny, I wonder, you have a lot of contact with students. Do you come across a lot that say, well, there's no point in voting anyway?
Of course. I mean, I don't like the stereotype of young people being apathetic, because I think young people have not really been given a reason to vote or a reason to trust. And so I think often it's not that apathetic. Like, often young people are engaged with campaigns, whether it's like, when I think about big campaigns, like a lot of young people have been involved. Bristol Students Union have been involved with women's rights campaigns, Reclaim the Night, LGBT campaigns, social justice campaigns, but they don't engage in party politics or voting, and that's because I think they've just lost faith in the system for exactly the sorts of reasons we've been talking about today, right?
So why did you? I mean, you might have been amongst that crowd who said, no, I don't really, don't take a great interest in party politics, but then you've decided, no, I'm going to. Well, what really made you do that? You said it was something to do with the mayor election.
I think it was timing. I think it was, I don't know, maybe it is just like being a middle class kid, if I'm really like brutally honest. It's being brought up and being told to engage and feeling like I should engage. But like, I got back to Bristol after I graduated, and I saw the Green Party saying things about not centralising power and saying something that was a bit different. And I think, we saw the Green surge and it did engage a lot more young people, and we had disproportionate numbers of young people compared to other parties. So I think when parties do say something different and do say something that engages with the needs of young people, then young people kind of respond to that. But I don't want to be dishonest about it.
Almost every time, if I speak to a student, a lot of the things they're always talking to me about is debt, because nobody wants to start their life racking up this enormous amount of debt. And that came up at Prime Minister's Questions again, in fact, this week.
Mark Pawsey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to ask the Prime Minister about Ruby. Ruby is one of my youngest constituents. She is just 1 month old. Why should Ruby face the prospect of spending her entire working life paying off the debt that's been built up by this generation?
I think Ruby
It's absolutely right to care about Ruby. When we became the government, £1 in £4 spent by the government was borrowed money. We had one of the biggest budget deficits anywhere in the world. And it's always easy for people to say, put off the difficult decisions, don't make any spending reductions. But what they're doing is burdening future generations with debt. And what I would say to the Labour front bench, that is not generosity, that is actually selfishness.
Well, this is a typical kind of sleight of hand. We're talking about this as if it's an intergenerational thing. The fact is that it's some people are never in debt. David Cameron, I'm quite sure, has never been in debt in his whole life. No doubt, as many middle-class people do, he took out a loan at university at a low rate of interest and no doubt paid it all back on time. So that was just free money for him. And, of course, his father was a multimillionaire, having pioneered setting up tax havens outside Britain. So to talk about him being in debt and Ruby being in debt, it's not really the same thing. And of course, ultimately, the reason why the deficit increased was because of the crash of Lehman Brothers and the international financial system. And in fact, you want the deficit to increase when you're in a crash. It should do automatically because tax receipts go down and unemployment benefit goes up. And if the state doesn't increase its expenditure at that point, the economy crashes through the floor. That's economics 101, which most people don't understand.
Well, I mean, this is all very easy to lay at a certain person's door, isn't it? Your former Prime Minister Gordon Brown in 2008, he said he saved the world. Actually, what he did is he plunged the entire Western world, and particularly here in Britain, into unpayable debt forever.
Well, what he did and what the Labour government did was what they didn't do. They didn't re-regulate the city after the Big Bang in 1987, which of course should never have happened. The Glass-Steagall Act repealed in the United States.
It's no good saying it shouldn't have happened.
No, but what should have happened when Labour came to power, when Tony Blair was elected, was they should have said, right, we're going to tackle the City of London. They're not going to be allowed to do what they've been doing up for the previous Tory era. And Brian Gould, who was Deputy Leader of the Labour Party at one stage, said, if you're not prepared to take on the City of London, I'm going back to New Zealand. And he did. He went back to New Zealand. In a huff. Yes, he's now head of Auckland University. But he said, the problem with the Labour Party in Britain is you're just not serious. That is a problem. They are lacking in seriousness.
On these more macro economic matters, do you think the Green Party's got any answers, Danny?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Green Party in 2015 in the general election, oh, that's this year, I talk about like it's the past, was saying the kind of things that you're saying about dealing with the city, regulating the banks, having a progressive tax system rather than becoming obsessed with the deficit and using that as a rationale for like ideological cuts. You know, to justify cuts that aren't necessarily dealing with the economy in the way that we need to.
But I think it was at Natalie Bennett, wasn't it? Famously, she was being grilled on the Daily Politics or one of these, or Newsnight, or was it Hard Talk, one of these TV shows, about universal credit or whatever
it is. Universal income.
Universal income, that's right, where everybody gets a bit of money, and she just couldn't work out the figures. So
I think
there is this impression, isn't there, that the Green Party have got some great ideas, but when it actually comes down to the hard economics, they're not going to be able to cope.
Yeah, I mean, I think Natalie Bennett gave a bad interview that confirmed people's kind of stereotype about the Green Party's numbers not being there. In actual fact, like, the manifesto that was released was fully costed, and like other manifestos, the predictions from the previous 2010 manifesto about the way the economy would go were more accurate than the other party's predictions had been. You know, I think like she didn't have the numbers on the day, and she released them later that day, but of course that wasn't reported because, you know, that's not good TV. I think it's a bit unfair to make a judgment on the Green Party's economics like based on one kind of crappy interview.
Okay, fair
enough.
But
don't grill me on the numbers.
No, okay, fair enough. Also, another big issue. We had the visit of the Chinese Premier, didn't we, the other week? And the BBC told us, didn't they, that EDF Energy has reached an agreement with China General Nuclear Power Corporation for a nuclear power plant at Hinkley Point in Somerset. Martin, this is going to cost an absolute fortune, final cost of $18 billion. But we heard from John Large, the nuclear engineer, the other week that it's going to be even more than that. And also that there are all sorts of problems with Flamanville in France, which is another nuclear power station EDF are building, which has developed some serious faults. And so the pressure vessel, which is this enormous steel sphere, which has been earmarked and built for Hinkley, is no longer going to come to Hinkley. They're going to have to take it to this other failed nuclear plant. plant in France, in Flamanville. So they're going to have to start again with the building the Hinkley pressure vessel for that reactor. The 25,000 jobs, which this should bring to the local area, looks great. But the cost from the electricity from this nuclear power station is going to be astronomical.
Well, it just doesn't add up. I think it's rather ironic and ridiculous, really. You've got an anti-state government that doesn't believe in the government intervention, and yet it's the Chinese and the French state are going to step in and take over this white elephant project, subsidised by the British taxpayer. And probably more money will be spent on Hinkley. It'll be the most expensive nuclear power station ever built. More public money will be spent on Hinkley than we're going to save by cutting tax credits. And of course, the other point I'd make about tax credits, just turning this, is that we're still talking about tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, how can you talk about that? If we're going to balance the books, then why are we talking about tax cuts for the wealthy?
Well, it's the wealthy that voted the Conservatives.
Well, indeed, but I mean, where's the logic there? There isn't any.
What do you make of this, Danny? Do you think this Hinkley point is going to go ahead?
I think it'll be delayed. I don't know to what extent it'll go ahead. I know that our MEPM Molly Scott-Cator is trying to put a challenge through European Parliament because they're saying it's kind of an unofficial subsidy. So saying that it's like the way that the British
the Austrians
are subsidising
the repeal, aren't they?
So I know that she's trying to challenge it. I hope it doesn't go ahead. I know that Caroline Lucas will be coming down to protest against it again. Like, you know, and the Greens obviously against nuclear power. I don't know what will happen.
Well, you say that, but I mean, surely there's a climate change aspect to this, where nuclear power is actually quite good, because it's not producing all this fossil fuel, it's not burning fossil fuel.
So people argue about it as being a halfway house. I think the argument from the Greens is that if you invest in that investment, you're not putting into green energy. And certainly, like Molly Scott-Cator released a report last year saying that all of the Southwest's energy could be provided by green energy. So, you know, then why invest? Is it a halfway house, or is it just because of corporate interest?
I mean, do you have any objection to nuclear power per se?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I mean, I think for the reasons I've just outlined, I'd rather see us investing in other sources of energy.
What sources? Well, you mean talking about windmills?
Wind,
sort of
solar, water.
And the other thing which should be mentioned is simply getting more efficient in the use of energy. It's the biggest answer. It's the answer staring us in the face.
Yeah.
We're so wasteful of the way we use energy.
Danny, give us an idea of your role anyway as Green Councillor. You're sitting on committees, that sort of thing. Because
yeah.
It's not just you don't just turn up for full council. You're doing stuff in between times, aren't you?
No, sure. So Bristol is. Like, we don't have kind of like local and county councillors. We're all one thing, a unitary council, I think it's called. And so I sit on full council, but then I also sit on neighbourhood partnership, which is delegated kind of decision making to like a local neighbourhood. I sit on the People Scrutiny Commission, so that's looking kind of education, health, care services in the city and scrutinising what the mayor and the executive are doing with those services. In theory, I sit on an IT group, but I've yet to be invited to those meetings. And of course, we're all trying to deliver kind of local campaigning in between this kind of, it's not just sitting on meetings. It's,
yeah, maybe you
know.
Can find out who it was that hacked Simon Cook's email account, as you were telling us about the other day.
I haven't heard about this.
On the IT side of
oh,
things.
Oh, right.
Somebody was found out, weren't they? They were disciplined, I understand.
Well, yes. It would be interesting to know a bit more about that, actually. You know, the idea that the City Council's email, someone can hack into it, is pretty frightening. On this sort of Edward Snowden and privacy thing, are you one of those who veers towards being concerned about secrecy or privacy or not?
Being concerned about... being worried for my security.
Concerned about surveillance and
passwords
or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Because there's quite a lot of people with the attitude, well, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about.
No, I mean, I think, like, who makes a judgment about what is to hide? And I think, like, the idea of profiling is quite disturbing with the way we see that, like... the way we see that, like, different groups and demographics have been profiled. You know, Jenny Jones... member of the House of Lords was on some sort of like watch list a few years ago. So like, who is it that's judging what is to hide? And I think
it's coming back to MI5 again, Martin, isn't it? Because these are the people making a lot of these decisions about who's dangerous, who's a threat to national security.
Well, in actual fact, in the US Constitution, as originally written in 1776, I can't remember what the clause is. It says that you should not interfere with private communications. unless you have a warrant from a magistrate. It's in the constitution. It's not even part of a legal.
It's in the law here.
Yes, so in other words, all of this spying by the intelligence services is strictly speaking illegal, and things that are not legal are illegal, and people should be prosecuted. That's what they're trying to do, is in an ex post facto way say, well, we've been spying on everybody, it's all right really. And in fact, it's not all right really. As I said, in the US constitution, it's absolutely explicitly forbidden.
Well, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, Green Councillor for Cotton, Danny Glazard. After the Murdoch News, we hear some from Geoffrey Dickins MP, who handed the lost VIP paedophile dossier to Tory Home Secretary Leon Britton back in the 1980s. That story that the London media hoped had gone away. We hear from him tonight.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.